Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. This is Chris Yaks from There Is a Solution Group at Barnegat, New Jersey. And please help me welcome Chris.
Good evening. My name is Chris Yaks. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic.
Hey.
Grateful to be alive and sober and in a sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous. That book surely saved my life. Fellowship did early on when I first came to AA. My sobriety date is August 17, 2005. I have a sponsor. He has a sponsor. I have a bunch of sponsees. I've got a relationship with God, and I practice these principles to the best of my ability in all my affairs. And tonight, I'll just ask you all to just hear what I have to say. It's going to be my experience, strength, and hope, and I'm probably going to talk about, well, I will talk about God and some other things at the end of my story. And I'm not here to tell you that you have to do what I did at all, but I'm going to tell you, that this is what happened to me by excellent sponsorship and men that truly are have a relationship with a higher power. They happen to call him God, too. I say recovered because, I'm not sick anymore. When I first came here, I was really out of my mind, quite frankly, because I drank for 28 years and did a lot of drugs, So drugs will probably be part of my story, and that's just the way it is, But I'm a real alcoholic that they describe on page 21, middle of 21, the real alcoholic, not the moderate drinker, not the hard drinker, thank you. And in Chapter 2 Wives on page 108 to 110, it describes the four alcoholics, and I surely did graduate from each level into the fourth and spun off somewhere in the fifth, which isn't written about. The book was written in 1939. But there's no need to change that book. I've been accused down where I live that I'm rewriting the big book, and I used to get resentments about that. But now would I just say, yeah, it's finished now, and guess what? There's no changes. No changes, but, that's a little bit of maybe arrogance, I guess, because I get a lot of darts thrown at me down where I live, and that's okay. I get a few guys that are interested in recreating their life, and that's truly a miracle, witnessing a miracle in front of my eyes. I say grateful because, through the 12 steps, it put me in a position to become willing for me to get out of the way, Chris Yaks, mind, ego, get out of the way, get rid of old ideas about God and the faith that was brought up on, and to relearn God and reestablish a whole brand new relationship with God. And that's what the 12 steps allowed me to do. I'll tell you where I'm at today for a little bit, and then I'll go on into my qualification. Recently, a couple weeks ago, I had flare-ups of untreated alcoholism, some anger, some resentment. And what happened was, I got a heads up from somebody at a business meeting that there were some people going to intergroup to Tar and Feather, our group. There is a solution group, because the middle of the road AAs don't like the solution. They don't. Pride and ego does not like to hear that, because I don't know. They're just hard drinkers, I guess. I'm not sure. But when I got the call, and I knew who this one lady was in the group, and today I call them AA Nazis, but maybe by remaining on this path of humility, I'll come to call them something else, children of God, But I'm human. I'm telling you the truth here, okay? I could bullshit you all night long because I'm a sales rep, but I'm trying to speak the truth tonight. So it was really interesting. I realized that night, I'm like, my God, there's something wrong with me, I'm still happy, joyous, and free, but that flare-up was just so powerful. I hadn't felt anything like that in a while. Now, I did these steps 3 years ago, and I've heard this guy, Peter Marinelli, talk about having to do these steps, he does them on an annual basis and shares them with, five, six other guys, so guys know where he's coming from, and know what he's about, so to speak, instead of walking around living a lie like some of us. I mean, I did when I first came here. Yeah, I'm all right, yeah, and I'm like pissed off inside, And then I'm listening to a CD I bought at an anniversary meeting. This guy, Mark Houston, was speaking. It was a CD from 1997, and the theme was called The Theater of the Lie. And he was talking about his own experience, and I could identify, because he talked about being 3 years sober and the manifestations of untreated alcoholism rising up, Because it's not about the drink or the drug for me anymore today, you know. It's that grave emotional mental disorder I suffer from, a disease of selfishness and self-centeredness. That's the root of my problems. And he talked about how self-delusion, self-seeking, self-righteousness was creeping in, you know. And I heard the CD like a couple times, about a week and a half ago, and I'm like, wow. So I called my sponsor right away. I said, Russ, I want to go through the steps again. So that's where I'm at. I'm going to be going through steps 1 through 3 with him tomorrow morning. You know, I'm looking forward to the experience. I'm going to, you know, I plan to share it with about 5 or 6 guys in different spectrums of their sobriety, you know, and maybe do it on an annual basis. I mean, for now, I'm doing it now, and that's all that matters. You know, a ton of bricks were dropped on me over the weekend. I just found out my daughter, you know, we call it, this is a family disease, by the way. I have a brother that's 11 years sober, and, you know, I'm sober now, and I got cousins that are sober, and, you know, we still have active alcoholics. So, you know, runs rampant in my family. Well, my daughter lost her son on Friday to her ex-in-laws, and what I discovered and was revealed to me that she's a heroin addict. And I think I was in denial for quite a while. She's been doing drugs since 15, and now here she is at 22, and my ex-wife is in denial, and so there's really nothing I can do. I can just pray, and I'm so grateful I have a relationship with God, because if I had untreated alcoholism going, my God, the thought of a drink or a drug would look really good for me. God keeps me safe and protected, and I got guys, you know, that I'm connected with that have experience with this stuff, you know, that I can talk to. They won't give me opinions; they'll give me experiences. One of them was, Chris, get your butt to Al-Anon, so I'm going this Thursday. So that's where I'm at on that situation. So, you know, the book says low spots. We will encounter low spots, not if and when, we will. And I can tell you, when you hear my story, you know, when I first got sober, man, I had a lot of low spots. And they didn't come at me today, but, you know, now that I'm a recovered alcoholic, you know, I'm recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, and I continue doing this spiritual fitness, if you will, each and every day. This stuff works. It's not a mystery. You know, I thought it was. You know, I started drinking at like 15, 1978. I grew up in Bucks County along the river, Point Pleasant. That's what they call a river rat, you know. Swimming in the river, jumping off bridges, fishing, bonfires, drinking, smoking, tripping. All of it. I didn't really like alcohol when I first drank it. I drank it on the weekends, you know, with a lot of keg parties. I went to Central Bucks East High School, which isn't too far from here. And I smoked a lot of grass. It was stone for 3 years, you know, 10th or 12th grade, 15 times a day. But I drank all around it, you know. I drank on the weekends. I hit some of the jackpots, you know. In high school, criminal trespass, criminal mischief, underage drinking, vandalism, you know. You know, we used to out in the country, maybe some of you guys have done this before, we go out driving around in the woods like in Tinicum Township and then think, well, let's smash some mailboxes. And we baseball bats out and a bunch of guys get out and just beat the crap out of a mailbox. Really stupid stuff, but it seemed like it was fun at the time. And that seemed normal, too, because that's who I hung around with, these other guys like me, and we all thought we were normal, you know, and whatever. And so I get out of high school, and I'm 18, and I'm just partying, and, you know, I'm not interested in college at the time, and, you know, my dad and mom are like, you know, what are you going to do with your life? I'm like, I don't know, you know, and I find myself hanging around with a couple guys on a particular day, and we broke into 2 houses, and they had been doing it, I guess, for a while, and, of course, lucky me, I do it with them for this one day, and we get caught, and, you know, I was facing 4 felonies per house. Yeah, I didn't really realize what it is, the extent of what we did to those people, you know, the invasion of their home and their privacy, because, you know, later on it ended up happening to me in my life. I was married, so, you know, talking about karma, I'm like, so, geez, that's not a good feeling, you know? I hit a jackpot there, 8 felonies. My parents think I have a drug and alcohol problem, and I don't, but I go away, you know. I go to a place called Today Rehab for 4 days, and I get up, and I'm like, I'm not sticking around here. You know, they're yelling at you and stuff, and behavioral modification, you know. like people could, they put their chair right in front of you and yell, and there's spits coming out. I'm like, goodbye. See ya. Yeah, so it was the summertime, summer of 1980, I think it was, yeah. And so I lived around a couple friends' houses for a few weeks and on the roof of Linden Elementary School in Doylestown. That was kind of interesting. It was, you know, thanks to drugs and alcohol. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to, you know, handle that. But because it helped you go to sleep at night when you took a sedative and drank a lot, you know. So I did that for a couple weeks. I went back to my parents and said, you know what? Yeah, I need help. I'll go to a rehab. So they put me in a place. It was Pennsylvania Hospital. It's called the Strecker Drug and Alcohol Program, 49th and Market Street. And there, I wasn't exposed to NA or AA. It was like a dual diagnosis thing. I think they thought I was a little nuts and had a problem with drugs and alcohol, you know. So they'd like the double locked door system and stuff like that. And so I think they had a goon button if someone freaked out, you know. But I didn't freak out. Well, because, you know, I was buying the stuff through the fences. You know, you could buy whatever you wanted because there was guys walking, you know, and it was metal wrought iron fence. You could easily hand money and get your stuff. So I was high the whole time. So I really didn't really get anything out of it except lie to an expensive psychiatrist that would tell me that I'm suffered from anxiety. And I'm like, yeah, no shit, you know. You would too if you were here, you know. Just anxious to get out. So I got out. Got out. Didn't graduate head of my class, but I ended up, my dad thought a geographical change would be good because, you know, living in a small town, everybody knew I was in the newspaper, you know, and the burglaries and everything. So I went down to Houston, Texas, down by the NASA Space Center in Taylor Lake Village, and I lived with my great aunt and great uncle for a little while. And, you know, I thought just getting away would be, okay, that's cool, I'll do that, you know, change the scenery, Texas, you know. And so I go down there, and I found the same friends. I looked for I had to go to probation. It got transferred from Bucks County down there. So I run into these two guys, two brothers, that were just like me, and they were at the probation office. And they lived, miraculously, about 10 minutes away from my great-aunt and great-uncle. What, I was like, wow, this is great. And we're in Houston somewhere, Center City, Houston, in a probation office, 45 minutes away, and I run into these two brothers, you know. And so I hook up with them and, you know, host other fair-weathered friends. And my aunt and uncle, they got tired of me coming home at night, you know, banging against their hallways and knocking pictures down. You know? So they're like, Chris, we think you should get your own place. I said, all right, that's cool. You know, no resentment. I said, no problem. Yeah. So I got an apartment with this other guy. He was nuts like me. And, you know, I was down there for about 2 years, and it was a good, you know, at the time it seemed like it was a good run, you know, because I wasn't going to college. I was just working, doing a lot of drugs and alcohol, engaging in sexual promiscuity, you know, all those activities that go along with it. And I did try a semester in college, and I got two F's and two C's. And I thought, man, I don't think college is for me, you know. So, again, I'm barely getting by, and I'm wondering, you know, how can I get my cash flow to a point where it will exceed, you know, the inflows will exceed the outflows, so then I can get other more stuff, you know. And I really never came up with a solution while I was down there. But, you know, my roommate and I were at odds with each other over time. You know, as you two full-blown, you know, alcoholics that are, like, progressively getting worse, and we get at each other's throats. I don't know if anybody's ever experienced that with a roommate, you know, that's just like you, and, you know, ego-driven and selfish and self-centered. So what happened was we had a party one night, and we were already talking about going our own ways. And I was on a motorcycle, and I thought, wouldn't it be cool? We had an enduro motorcycle in our apartment on the second floor. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool if I just popped a little wheelie and stopped in time while everybody's there, you know, just show off, you know, and then stop in time before I hit an interior wall. Well, you know, my senses were down, and I didn't stop in time, so I crashed through the interior wall. And he was very mad. You know, he was very, very mad. And I think all I just said is, here, have another beer, whatever, you know, another line, another pill. And we left. We departed our own ways the next morning. I called some cousins of mine up in the Woodlands, Texas. I said, hey, can I stay with you guys for about a week? I'm heading back to Pennsylvania. I'm going to go to college, you know. They're like, yeah, sure. You know, so I bail out. He bails. And to this day, I've tried to find him, you know, through People Find and Facebook, and he's nowhere to be found because I did want to, he made my amends list, obviously, and to this date, I've not been able to find him yet, but I never heard from him. I never knew what happened to him or, you know, to that day, whenever that day was. I think it was August of 82. But then I called my dad in the interim as I'm leaving that apartment, going with my cousins. Dad, I'm ready to go to college now. Can you give me a ticket? Well, let's go, you know. So he's like, okay. He's like, we got a couple ground rules. I said, what's that? He says, well, you can't be selling drugs, you know, and we really don't want drugs in the house. Okay, no problem. You know, because drinking was cool. You know, that was okay. And my dad, I don't know if he was an alcoholic or not. I really don't know. But if he was a real darn good functional alcoholic, you know. So I went back home. And I started going to Bucks County Community College, and I was working at Pipersville Inn, and you know, waiting tables, washing dishes, helping the cook, whatever. And that was a great job for an alcoholic like me, because you know, there was beer down in the basement. You know, it was always open, and the chef, this guy Maurice, loved to drink beer and talk about hockey. So I'm like, yeah, you know. So during the week, we'd be hanging out and be like, ah, oh, Chris, go get down and get some St. Pauli girl. Okay. So I go down, we get them in the fridge. But we drink about 10, 12 beers each a night and talk about hockey and, you know, work. It wasn't hard work, you know. And before I left, I'd snag a bottle of champagne and, you know, chug that on the way home. Just disgusting, quite frankly. But it was easy to get because it was by the door, you know. So I'm going to college, and I'm barely getting by at Bucks and getting, like, C's, I guess. And, of course, you know, obviously I don't know that I'm really an alcoholic at that time. But, you know, I'm a blackout drinker. You know, I'm forgetting what went on, what happened. And sometimes I remembered. But, you know, I would always be told, Chris, wow, you know, you were hilarious. Or, Chris, you know, you were a real dick, you know. Oh, really? What happened, you know? Well, you had a great time, or you almost got in a brawl with this guy or whatever. All right, okay, you know. And I never thought anything was anything wrong. I thought that was normal, you know. I did get a little mini jackpot, a DUI, coming out of New Hope. I crashed my 66 Chrysler Newport into a ditch, and it cut the bottom of the car in half, and my cousin hit the windshield to get a little star crack in there. But Solbury cops, Solbury finest, took me away, and I lost my license. I forget what it was back then in 1983 in Pennsylvania. Maybe it was like 3 months, I don't know. Of course, my parents looked at me with a look of disgust, and they're like, well, you can hitchhike wherever you need to go, you know, or maybe we'll give you a ride, you know. So I did. I hitchhiked all the time, you know. I didn't care. So I'm going to college, and I'm getting toward the end of the ride, you know, 60 credits, 2 years. You know, I'm like, what am I going to do now? So I decided, I knew this guy. He was an engineering major, and we talked about, well, maybe we'll go to Villanova. We'll transfer there, you know. And I'm an older student. I was 21 when I went to college, so at that time I was about 23. So we lived off campus in Wayne. And I thought, my mind was thinking, well, you know, Villanova will be a good school to go to because, you know, it's like a small Catholic school, and it's in like a town where there's just not a lot of, you know, frat house row and stuff like that, you know, animal houses, because there wasn't in Radnor Township, you know. And that was my thinking, you know. But, you know, I would go up to Penn State. My cousin was an social activities director up there, and I go up there. I wouldn't even remember any of the weekend and get back home and think I had fun. I never went to a football game. I was too stupid. I couldn't go in, you know. But, again, I don't realize I have a problem. And nobody's pointed it out, really, that I had a problem either. And I think maybe that was because of my craftiness of making sure I hung around with people that drank like me, you know. Because they didn't remember either. So two people that don't remember, that's great. I'm at Villanova, and I meet my wife. She's actually my girlfriend, and, you know, we're doing drugs and drinking and engaging in promiscuous sexual activity. And she informs me she's pregnant, and I'm like, all right, fabulous. Well, let's get married. You know, so we decided to get married, and it was a real Cinderella affair down in New Hope at the Fountainhead. Her mother, I never hit it off with that lady from the get-go. So that was going to be the root of, like, deep resentments that would brew over the 11 years of that marriage, you know. And so we get married, beautiful daughter. She's a heroin addict now, but she's still a beautiful girl, and hopefully through God's grace, you know, she'll get touched as well. It won't take as long as me. So we moved to Illinois, Rockford, Illinois, because her dad's a big shot with Squibb Pharmaceutical in Chicago, and she wanted to be closer to her parents, and, you know, I don't care, whatever, you know, let's go, get our stuff and go. I know nobody in the Midwest, you know. So we go, and she gets a job as a pharmaceutical rep in Rockford. And I ended up getting a job with the hospital, St. Anthony Medical Center. And I'm doing physician recruiting, practice acquisitions, and physician relations, reporting to the CEO of the hospital. It was a very political job. You know, I loved it because, you know, as alcoholics, a lot of us, you know, we know the Potomac two-step real good, you know. And that's the kind of job that was, you know, highly visible, highly political, not that you were, I was shady or anything. It's just you're very crafty with your words, you know. And but since I mixed with the physicians, and she called on the physicians, our jobs kind of complemented each other. So like if she were having these drug dinners back in the day, you know, it was like anything went. You could get whatever you wanted on the drug companies. You could eat the finest foods. You could drink the Louis XIII cognac. It's like $105 for a snifter, or $1,500 for a bottle, you know. And that's not a problem. We're smoking cigars, you know, just back in the late 80s into the mid 90s, you know. So, of course, I loved those functions, you know, loved them, you know. And, of course, my job, entertaining doctors, she would be there, too. And, you know, I got to golf, you know, I got paid to golf. I mean, what a great job as an alcoholic. I mean, I was like the Pope of the hospital. I loved that job. I loved that job. And I wasn't getting any jackpots. Everything was cool. You know, it's in the Midwest. Everybody's mellow and polite and conscientious. And I'm down with that, you know. I'm down with that. So, you know, it was like that movie Zelig, Woody Allen, how he fits into his environment, like they put him in a, you know, in with monkeys, and he looked like a monkey and acted like a monkey, you know. It's a great movie if you haven't seen it. So I'm going on. We have a son in 1992. One night I hear a pharmacist talk about, see, we had all kinds of drugs in our basement. And I'm sorry, but these are legal things I'm going to talk about. These aren't street things, okay? They happen to be in my basement. And I hear this guy talk about how the one particular product we had in the basement was the most sought after by drug seekers at the time. It was called Stadol Nasal Spray. And what they would do is take an Actifed, which is an antihistamine, which we had in our house because we had allergies, my wife and I. And we also had the Stadol down in the basement. And he said they would do that and it would mimic a speedball, heroin and coke together. And I thought, wow. I'm not into needles. I've always wondered what that was like. So when I got home, I took an Actifed and tried that. And I got hooked on that stuff. I read it and it said, non-addictive, but maybe habit-forming. And I thought, oh, that's good. Non-addictive. Excellent. Yeah. So, what I came to realize was, you know, at the time, I didn't think I had a problem. I just thought I was just getting high. Catching a buzz. But what I came to realize was, I led a double life out there. You know, it's like, you know, my wife would go to bed, I'd tuck my kids into bed, and then I'd go downstairs and do that stuff and drink and watch TV, sports, or veg on video games, and I thought that was normal, you know. You know, looking back, now that I'm sober, you know, more and more is revealed about just how, you know, nuts I really was, just how off-center I really was. I mean, I thought I was a shit, man. I was in, like, reality. I was far from reality, man, back then. And I'll tell you one other story. In Illinois, my wife had a brunch in Chicago and a game at Wrigley Field to follow, the Cubs, you know, friendly confines at Wrigley Field. If you're ever out there, go see a game at Wrigley. It's just wonderful. But We go to the brunch, but I was in charge of getting the garbage cans full of beer and the split champagnes because my wife likes champagne. Of course, I always would get them for the bus trips, but this particular bus trip, I got everything. And I got more than enough for everybody, because when it was leftovers, it went in my refrigerator and I drank it. Again, sky was the limit with the drug companies back then. So we drink, we have the brunch, then we go to the baseball field. And, you know, I'm one of those alcoholics that becomes dangerously antisocial at times. Well, many times, you know. I'm not violent. I just not comfortable with just being calm or mellow, you know. I'm jacked up and I'm not on crank or anything. I just want to make stuff happen if it's not happening. So I'm sitting there in Wrigley Field on the second level, and the thought crosses my mind, wouldn't it be cool to, you know, get a hot dog and just chuck it over and just throw it on some people and see what happens, you know? So I did. I went and got a hot dog, and I threw it, and of course all the physicians and their wives were aghast, so was my wife. And the people down below, they looked up, they were cursing, and they didn't come up. I was lucky I didn't get my ass beat, but I thought that was funny. That was normal. You know, let's just throw it over and see what happens. I like to throw things at stadiums. You know, I've been known to throw beer, you know, at Eagles fans in Philly Stadium. That's insane. And I'm a Giants fan. Giants, Eagles, and pegging a guy, all right? Yeah, G-Man. We got ripped off this year. So that just gives you an idea of my out. You know, I'm like, I'm the real alcoholic. I'm out of my freaking mind. And those resentments I told you about have just been brewing against my ex-mother-in-law and my ex-father-in-law and my wife, because, you know, I was like this Mr. Mom guy, because she was a career-oriented woman, and I had my career, but I didn't care taking a back seat. I'm like, hey, go ahead, get your MBA, you know, whatever, you know, have at it. And so I would always do the cleaning, the laundry, whatever, the dishwashing. And I used to get really ticked off at times because, you know, my friends were out, you know, going to gentlemen's clubs and cheating on their wives. Didn't have to do any of that stuff that I did. And I'm like, I'm doing something wrong here. You know, but I thought, well, that's what a husband was supposed to do. A real husband was supposed to keep his mouth shut, have his things removed, and just do as he's told, you know? And that would manifest into like a major resentment over 11 years of marriage, you know. I mean, when I got divorced, he says, I'll take those back. You're going to have everything. Goodbye. That's what it was like. So there's a little humor, but I'm just saying. And the dissolution of our marriage, I know I played at least 50%. I'll take 50% at least responsibility for that. You know, maybe more. I don't know. But I will accept 50%. You know, because I was out of my mind. I was just thinking about me. I didn't have any solution as to how to talk to her or get some extra help or I don't know. Drinking and any other stuff was my solution. And stuffing it in, man, you know. And then occasionally burst out, you know. Like one time, I do the laundry, and I put a pink thing in with whites, and everything got freaking pink, and she was, you know, yelling at me, and I'm like, you know what? And she says, I quit. You do it. I said, do you think a magical elf, like, washes the dishes and empties the dishwasher and does the laundry, everything's folded and put away? Do you think there's an elf that does that, you know? And she said, no. But then I ended up still doing it, and that was just a fleeting moment of a lash out at her. So we move. Marriage is going in the toilet. This is like March of 97. She takes a promotion with Bristol Myers Squibb, product marketing person with, I forget what drug it was. Prinivil, or no, Monopril, a once-a-day ACE inhibitor. And I'm a trailing spouse finishing my graduate school training, five-month trailing spouse. And I'm coming home 1 to 2 weekends a month, and I know nobody in out east. I got no connections. I don't know how I'm going to find a job. But I'm just like, whatever. Again, whatever. And maybe a geographical change or marriage will get resurrected from the ashes of oblivion, you know. Well, that didn't happen. When I was coming out August 22nd, 97, she informed me she needed her space and she didn't want me living there. So I said, that's fine. You can have all the space you want. I'm divorcing you. I'm through. And I did. And again, not thinking like, well, maybe a period of separation might be okay for now. You know, I just went right to the jugular. Goodbye. You know, and that would be the root of an 8-year just living hell that I would embark on. It was a tit for tat family court. spend tens of thousands of dollars, and really for nothing. I look back and I think, God, those lawyers, man, they are a bunch of scumbags. Divorce lawyers. Maybe God will grace me someday to look at them as God's children, but, you know, my experience shows me, and $80,000 later, and, you know, both of us still, like, kind of ticked off at each other. I mean, I'm not ticked off at her anymore, but she is at me. And just a calamity that occurred. I'm not going to try and lay blame, but I'm just saying, I was an alcoholic at the time, so I jumped into all this, too. Maybe if I were where I'm at today, I wouldn't have engaged an attorney. I would have just did it myself and say, yes, Your Honor, uh-huh. Yes, how much do I pay? Uh-huh. Sure. Uh-huh. Here. You know, but I had to fight, and she fought. We fought. We both fought. And, you know, it was just the alcohol brought moments of joy to me through those times, okay? But also, in the pain and anguish and misery, the alcohol helped stuff it and kill it. You know, it was like that, we hear about the hole in the soul. I had the hole in the soul. It was getting bigger and bigger. And in 2002, she informed me she got married and wanted to go to Orange County, California. And I fought vehemently. Another 25,000 shrinks. And I'm on Xanax, I smell like booze from the night before, and I got to see this shrink, and he's taking my inventory, and I'm standing up, I'm like, you know, dude, you don't know anything about me. I'm getting in this guy's face. You know, of course, he's writing up, the guy's clinically insane, let the children leave, you know. So my lawyer says, well, they won the first round. I said, what does that mean? Well, we can bring them back for a trial and more shrinks, blah, blah. And I said, you know what, I'm done. Done. So I would continue to drink until August 16, 2005. I had a great job with Johnson & Johnson, you know, selling stents for cordis endovascular, stents and balloon angioplasty catheters. For me, it was like the pinnacle of one's career if you're in the medical field, medical devices. And you know, I didn't really appreciate it, really. I mean, I was making big money and throwing money around, you know, like Bill Wilson, you know, writing the checks and the banker looking over, you know, with skepticism, like, what's up with this guy? This can't last long, you know. You know, golfing, I can identify with Bill Wilson's story entirely, you know, golfing around, you know, getting that impeccable coat of tan that the well-to-do, you know, get. But, you know, I wasn't out for the tan, I was out for the drinking and trashing the carts because I love to take them off-road, you know, into the woods and stuff. So from 02 to about 05. So then Johnson & Johnson started to tell me, Chris, we think you have a drinking problem as far back as in 03. Chris, we think you have a drinking problem. No, I don't. No. I was a little pissed off, man, a little bit. I just got done family court or family court's right around the corner again. You know, just relax. It's all good. But I was always posting the numbers, putting up the numbers for them. And, you know, they'll look the other way, but they kept reminding me, you know, some of the antics I would do at the national sales meeting. You know, one of them was, toward the end of my ride, June of 05, I'm at the Sawgrass Marriott down in Florida. And I ended up winning this golf outing. It was between the Metro Division and, you know, for bragging rights and a big bronze trophy. But no money. You know, just ego. Ego, you know, fueled trophy. And I won the thing, and I'm five sheets to the wind by the pool. It's about 120 reps there, and the VPO, they're all there. And I decided I'm just going to jump in the pool with my golf shoes, shirt, and shorts on, because it's hot, and I'm drunk, and I just won, and hallelujah! So I jump in, and I get out, and you know, everybody's looking at me. I'm like, what's up, man? Hey, give me another scotch, you know? So I'm drinking, and I'm drinking all night long. Finally, my clothes dry, you know, over time, because I never changed my clothes. And later that night, it's about 1 in the morning, we're going back to our room, and there's a bridge. And it was like a couple alligators on the bridge about an hour before. It's about 12 of us, you know, in this posse, walking back to the rooms. And I get the keen idea, I'm going to jump in that canal to the other side, and I'm going to bet people, you know, see who wants to take the bet that an alligator won't get me. So I'm like, I'll bet anybody $20 so I can get a swim across the other side without an alligator getting me. And of course, about four guys put up $20. That was enough. And I got a couple managers like, Chris, don't do it, like down at the banks. Don't do it. I'm like, get out of here. And I dive in, you know, Mark Spitz, you know, shallow dive, sprint, hold my breath across the other side, made it, got out, got the 80, and went to my room thinking, wow, what have I just done? I think I'm going to be in trouble. But then I had another drink and went to sleep. So that's the nature of my my drinking, out of my mind, and blacking out a lot, and just really, really no respect for my own life, you know, quite frankly, reckless abandon. So I was on a 5-day bender. I won't get into the details, but it was just a 5-day blur, you know, from the PGA on Thursday, Baltusrol to Coney Island on Sunday, to golfing on Monday, and then August 16th, Tuesday morning, I woke a broken man, emotionally and spiritually bankrupt. There was nothing left of me. You know, I couldn't do it. I wanted to die, you know. And I had all the white stuff, I had the Xanax sticks, I had the alcohol and the chronic doobie all right there on the counter. But it was like Humpty Dumpty falling off the wall, and just none of that stuff would put me back together again. So I guess it was I had a moment of clarity to call my brother, and I told him, I said, Chuck, I'm a mess. I got a problem. And he said, all right, good. I've been waiting for this call. I've been praying for 7 years. I said, so, you know, I finished all the stuff on the counter and drove to Pipersville. Well, I waited a couple of hours. I had to finish everything. Okay? And I'll be honest with you, I was not even, it didn't even affect me. I didn't even catch a bus that day. And I get there about 5 o'clock up at Pipersville, my mom's house. And you know, he's helped me get into this place called the Karen Foundation. Because that's where I wanted to go. And that's where he went in 96. I thought, well, he went there, I'll go there and I'll get sober. And of course, I'm still out of my mind. Bear with me here. I'm nuts. But I'm willing to go to rehab now. And they didn't have a bed for a few days. So I said, hey, you know what, Chuck, don't worry about it. I'll go to the shore the last week of August, because our parents have a house at Sea Isle on the beach. Let me just do that thing, and then I got the tickets to Green Day concert, Labor Day weekend, and then I'll go right after that. He says, no. He says, you'll either change your mind, you'll kill some people, or you'll kill yourself. So he got on the phone, he got me a bed, so I went in on August 18th, and my first meeting was at Frenchtown on August 17th. Yeah, I'm like new, and even though I wasn't high, I was just from the after effect of all that drinking. I don't really remember. Like, one girl came up to me once. I spoke at a meeting down at Baptist Town. She says, oh, you remember me? I spoke with you that first night you were at AA, you know, in Frenchtown. I said, nah, man. I'm like, sorry, I don't, but thank you for talking to me. I was like probably a zombie, you know. He took me up to the rehab, and, you know, I was crying, man. I was like dry heaving, like crying. And I think, you know, for me, that experience was, you know, the jig was up, man. You know, it was a cry of joy, I believe, but also a cry of sorrow, because, you know, the mind is like, oh man, no more of this stuff, we're done. You know, that's what I think I thought at the time. But I get into rehab, I'm out of my mind. You know, I'm walking around, yeah, you know, yeah, I'm a great I am here. Bull my way through life, self will run riot, man. Self propulsion, you know, just, you know, incredible ego. I was built up over years, and you know, I decided, you know, the big book's not for me. I'll read the 12 and 12. Thank you. You know, because you know, I think just getting a B in AA, that's good enough. Because when I was at Villanova, they wanted us to read these two classic books called the Iliad of Homer and the Odyssey of Homer, thick like this. I'm like, I'm not reading those. Getting those black and yellow books are called Cliff Notes, about that big. And I got a B in the class, so I thought the 12 and 12 was kind of like that. Again, whacked. So, I don't even know AA is going to follow. I think I'm just getting tuned up a little, and, you know, I'm going to be all freaking better when I come out, you know. New man. Well, I come out of there, and he says, look, get a home group, get a sponsor, get a relationship with higher power, be of service, you know. And, all right, good. So I go, and I look around where I live. It's piney. Piney town, you know, Ocean County, good folks, but just nobody's quite like me, because I'm still unique. And I decide I'm going to sponsor myself. Yeah, I think I can do a better job than any of these people could. So if anybody's doing that now and you're a real alcoholic, go get a sponsor quickly. You know, relapse is not part of my story. By the grace of God, good sponsorship and big book Alcoholics Anonymous, and also for me, the bigger book that's got chock full of truth, like AA book. So I walked around, a lot of pain and emotion. You know, I hurt a lot of pain and emotionally, you know, unsturdy, angry. I didn't want to drink. J&J informs me a week out of rehab, Chris, you're done. We don't need you anymore. What? Yeah, you violated health care compliance rules again. Remember when you signed that thing and said you wouldn't do it again, but you did it? Oh, well, wait a minute. And they're like, you know, like, you're not getting paid anything. You know, you're done. Just get out of here. You know, the highest termination you could possibly get, you know, without jail time. And I said, wait a minute. I was inebriated when I did that. And the HR guy doesn't back stuff. He's like, ugh. So I'm like, look, I'll tell you what. I want out, too. You want me out? Give me some cash, and I'll walk. So they were very good to me, Johnson & Johnson. Very, very good and patient to me. They paid me through the end of the year, through January of 06, vested me for 5 years, and they didn't have to do that stuff. And they did. But then I lose my job. I'm like, all right, so I'm sober now. I'm fired. Now I got a jackpot I'm waiting for. I got a DUI in a golf cart, July of 05, over in front of a bar near my house. I thought it'd be cool to ride around in a golf cart one night, you know, and I got a pocket full of blow and chronic doobies. So, I mean, the guy, when he got me, he hit the jackpot, you know, and I'm coming out of the bar. I'm like, yo, what's up, man? I got headlights on this thing. Come on. No inspection, no license, no insurance. Oh, you got a basket full of empty beer cans, open beers. Oh, what's this? And I'm like, oh, wait a minute. I go, I'm having a party. I borrowed those shorts off someone. Those aren't my shorts. He says, get in the car. So I was facing that when I got out. And that was, I call that an $8,000 jackpot. I mean, I'm killing all my savings. Everything's just, you know, like for me, I look back. Thank God I got off that rail, that merry-go-round when I did, because already the wreckage was already set in place that was going to cascade upon me. It hadn't started happening until I got sober, but it was all there. It wasn't going away. So I got out reckless driving on that, and that was it. And that was another miracle. And the drugs charge, the cop wasn't a certified calibrator, so it got thrown out. You know, I mean, what a miracle. So I would be unemployed for about 2 months. I mean, 2 years. And I'm scratching my head like, my God, am I like a mental defective? I mean, Jesus, I got no record. I got no skeletons in my closet. But I got this this mind. When I go on job interviews, I'm thinking, he knows. He knows. And the people in AA are telling me, oh, you don't have to tell him. You don't have to tell him. You know, and I'm like, I'm thinking, okay, I don't have to tell him. Let's see, I'm not a good liar, sober, you know. And nothing was working. And I'm freaking ready to lose it. But then God put a sponsor in my life, December of 05, and he started bringing me through these steps. And he was a man, you know, God-centered man, a man that was sober for some time, but had been doing, you know, practicing these principles in all his affairs, and has a sponsor and sponsored others. He was also a drug and alcohol counselor to boot. When he gave me his card, I'm like, I got a 2-for-1 on this one. I can't dope beam this guy, and I couldn't. Oh, this guy beat my ass into submission. Absolute ego deflation. You know, through this process of these steps, you know, step one, powerless over alcohol. My life was unmanageable. Sure, I'm down with that. That's why I went to rehab. But then I get out, my life is still unmanageable. You know, I really never really understood or really fully appreciated step one until, you know, until as I did this work for a while. Because I could still be drinking at a bar and drinking and be pounding at the bar like, Jesus, I'm powerless over alcohol. You know, I hear in meetings when I, you know, anyway, I still hear it. You know, the guy's like, we do step one, right, every day. We don't drink. You know, they got this shit. And I tell my guys, don't buy into that crap. That's a lie. Because you could be drinking and accept that you're powerless and your life is unmanageable. Because that's where the physical compulsion comes in once you take the drink, man. You know, do I accept I have a mental obsession that centers in my mind? That's step one. And if there's no mental defense against my first drink, man, you know, step two, restored sanity by a power greater than myself, and that was God. You know, I had this God, you know, this God from the Catholic faith I grew up on, so it was something I could work with. It wasn't much, but it was something. I mean, not because of the religion, it's just what I didn't learn while I was in that, going to church and Sunday school and crap like that. So, you know, I move on to step three. I hand my life over to the care of God. I made a decision, so then we embark on a journey to do this fourth step right away. You know, I would hear in contemporary AA meetings while I sponsored myself, and I still hear it today, well, you know, I just do steps one through three every day, and I haven't finished the steps. And, you know, and again, I tell guys that I work with, I get to teach them. I remain a student, but then I get to teach. I said, you know, you don't stay on step three, dude. If we're doing step three, you're making a decision, and let's go. It's time. Here's the inventory sheets. Well, we're going to give you a couple weeks, man. You know, and I had to take 3 months, though. And I tell them that because I had this thinking mind that was like, oh, my God, I might cry because what a shitty dad I was and just what a dick I was to my mom and, you know, just, oh, my God, you know, and remorse, guilt, and shame, you know, God forbid. I take a look at that. So, you know, or I might miss something. Oh, and when one of my guys says that, I'm like, just do it. If you miss it, we'll do a step 10 real quick, okay? But I tell them my own experiences, you know, coming in, sponsoring myself. So I don't want them to think that, you know, all of a sudden, poof, I got this right out of rehab either, you know. But I try to speed it up for them. I said, look, I'm going to try and speed you up here, man. So then, step 4, do the inventory. I share with my sponsor. I come to realize that there's nothing unique about me. He shares things about himself. You know, and it was just, wow, what an exchange with another man and God. And he says, Chris, you know, basically he wasn't a priest, but he said, you're absolved of all these sins, you know. And you know, with God's grace, and walk now. It's time. Walk. You know, let go. Not this way. This way, he would tell me. Okay. But sometimes I still had to let go this way, you know. This way. And then, you know, that's when I started feeling the freedom, you know, walking through this archway of freedom. 6 and 7, nothing miraculous happened to me. You know, we sat down and talked about the character defects. God, I want you to remove them. Humbly ask you, to remove them. Nothing magical happened. I'm here to report. But it was a willing to go through and have a discussion about these defects of character and how to get rid of those through God's grace and discipline. You know, 8 made the list, 9 made the amends, you know, pretty much current on all amends except my ex-wife, and I'll see her in family court February 20th, and I thought, you know, hopefully, you know, if God moves me on that day, you know, to do that, then I'm fully prepared to do it, but I don't put an attachment to the future, you know, that hasn't occurred. You know, that's the beauty of this program that it's taught me. No remorse, guilt, or shame about the past. Hold no attachment to the future of anything that has not occurred yet to me. Stay in the day, one moment, this moment, right here, right now. That's a relationship with God, good sponsorship, good teachers, you know. There's no mystery to this. That happy, joyous, and free, everybody can have it. The fourth dimension rocketed, anybody can have it. The thinking mind's got to be taken out, man. You know, that's what happened. Like, I had to mentally condition myself to beat that subconscious ego down and read spiritual literature over and over and over until something happened where there was a shift in consciousness, you know, where that psychic change occurred in me. And that was through these 12 steps, but most of it occurred after doing the 12 steps, I'll be honest with you. You know, 10, you know, yeah, I take personal inventory each and every day. You know, if I piss someone off, hey, I'm sorry if it comes to me that I did. Later that night, I'll reflect my night. I don't necessarily write written inventory down. I probably should start doing that, but I do actually do contemplate the day and where I was wrong. Do I need to make some amends, you know? The next day, and I asked God to make me willing to do that. Step 11, you know, the spiritual part. I'm going to go back to that, but first I'm just going to go to step 12. You know, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, which I had, my sponsor guaranteed I'd have one. I had one. I was skeptical at step 1, you know, because I'm a highly educated man. I don't know if anybody can identify any MBAs in here, you know. You know. God, that's like one of the biggest barriers for people like us. We got to carry this message to other alcoholics. This message is that message that's found in the foreword of the first edition, where it says, you know, it's how we precisely have recovered is the main purpose of this book. You know, someone pointed out to me this past summer. I'm like, wow. I never really noticed that sentence. And now it jumps out at me because I tell the guys I work with today. I said, don't buy into the bullshit. You know, the sobriety that's unique to somebody. You need to get in and qualify the guy if he's a real alcoholic. If he is, then if he qualifies himself, then you tell him he's in grave danger if he doesn't do these steps, man. You know, and then show him that sentence in the book. If he does these 12 steps, this is what the 12 step, that middle part is about. This book showing others how we have recovered. No Dr. Phil, Kukla, Fran, or Ollie. No, you know, fake it till you make it. You know, just garbage. Killing things in AA, quite frankly. Killing things in AA. And try to practice these principles in all our affairs. You know, what does that look like? Well, you know, I got so many freaking old ideas, even after the 12 steps. You know, How do I learn that? What happened to me? January of 07, I heard a guy, Peter Marinelli, spoke in Staten Island. You know, we got to drive pretty good distances to hear people that are solution-based, that are real alcoholics. Because where I live, unfortunately, and I'm not trying to be the chief critic, okay, here, there's just a lot of shit thrown around in the rooms. There's a lot of hard drinkers down there, and psychos. Like, AA is full of, like, nut jobs. And I'm nuts, too. Let me qualify. I have a grave emotional mental disorder called alcoholism. But there's other nuttiness, you know, nuts. But I'm not a psychiatrist. I can't diagnose other people. But the third tradition would indicate that we have a lot of nutbags, aside from alcoholics, because the third tradition states the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Great. It's all-inclusive. You let me stay. Thank you. Glad. But thank God someone showed me this book. Chris, let's see where you stand. You know, I don't know. If he would have said, Chris, you're a moderate drinker or a hard drinker, well, you're welcome to stay. Have coffee with us. Talk about drama, you know. But for God's sakes, keep your mouth shut. But that's not my story. I'm a real alcoholic. And I'm grateful that someone showed me this book. And I remain a student of this book each and every day. I look to have new experiences with this book anytime I can do it. Like, I'm going to, like, a big book retreat the end of March up at the Wilson House with Chris Schroeder and Chris Raymer, the one-eyed bandit from Texas, if anybody's ever heard him. Phenomenal speaker. And then the end of May, I'm going to Long Branch, St. Alphonsus. Peter Marinelli and a couple guys are doing a big book retreat. I don't know. It's my life, man. I stay in the middle of that triangle. I've been there for quite a while. I've heard others talk about it at the podium. You know, one is guaranteed not to drink again if one stays in the middle of that triangle. And I believe that. I see it in others, and it works for me. I don't think of a drink or a drug. I shared with you a couple issues that I'm working through, not on my own willpower. No human power could relieve me of my alcoholism. You know, God couldn't, would if he were sought. So I'm doing these steps with my sponsor and God again. But I'm going to touch on step 11. I've got 1 minute or 2 minutes. And again, I don't want anybody to, you know, if any chief critics are here right now in their mind, just ask God to remove that for now. Okay, I'm a cat, fallen away Catholic, you know, recovering Catholic, just jokingly. Okay, so after the 12 steps, I got the God thing going, but it's a delusional God because it's a buffet God. When things are going great, I'm like happy, joyous, and free. When stuff isn't happening, I'm a mess in my mind and I'm manufacturing misery. I have a traveling shit show going on. And I'm like, what is going on? You know, so then someone tells me to read Sermon on the Mount by Emmett Fox, published in 1934. So I'm reading it, and I'm like, oh, my God, whoa. Wow, okay, yeah, all right, I can dig that. Yeah, okay, there's character defects here. I've got to change that. Mm-hmm. So what it did is I read it like 4 times, and it just lit me up. It gave me the opportunity to relearn God and reestablish a whole brand-new relationship with God. Down with that, great. Then I find out that summer that was a book that was required by the first 100 alcoholics to read and study. Cool. I found out later, Book of James was another one. So what happened was, we got a meeting started March of 07 at the Bayside Chapel, Solution Base. You know, for those that are tired of hearing Bob Newhart cycle babble, garbage. But we still go to those meetings to look for the new guy, quite frankly. And then someone told me to go to this service because the pastor, he's just a messenger, speaks first century Christianity principles. So I go, and I was like, wow, my God. I was like lit up again. I'm like, this is incredible. Parallel, all what he talked about was parallel to the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, which is founded on first century Christianity principles, and Sermon on the Mount. So I started going. I signed up for the church. I got rebaptized and all that stuff because, you know, I was incapable at the time what I'd learned. Since my mom got me baptized as a Catholic as an infant, that I was incapable of having a relationship with Christ. So I actually formally, you know, accepted Christ as my Savior, and it's one of the greatest decisions I ever made in my life. First one was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. Second one was that. So what's it like now? Well, now that the truth is revealed, it's hard for me to go back and, like, sin or do this, like 13-stepping shit or, you know, gambling, stealing, cheating, lying. Now, I'm a human being. I'm still not perfect. I still judge people in my mind. I've been known to character assassinate people. But I'm awake and aware to that, and I'm asking God to help me. Help me with that, you know, because it's not my place to be judging others. We're all God's children, okay? So what am I doing now? I get all my guys that I get to sponsor, What a beautiful thing. I get to do this, man. And watch guys light up, you know. And I say, come with us for the Bible study class. We go Saturday mornings. We're starting to learn the book of James now. Cool. And then Tuesday night we're going to go this other person's house to learn about the Sermon on the Mount, you know, out of the Gospel of Matthew. I'm not saying any of you guys have to do this, but if you're anything like me, if you're like a Catholic or a Protestant or whatever, you know, and you haven't considered this, find a spiritual teacher. You know, find a spiritual teacher that can teach you. Like I found a teacher that could teach me the book, and I have the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to find a teacher to teach me that. And I can't explain what's happened to me, but, you know, I do feel the presence of God within me, and all of you, quite honestly. But I just, you know, this stuff is real, man. You know, it really is. And I can't say enough for it. So I'm going to continue doing this work. I hope I brought you a typical meeting, and that's all I got. Thank you.
Group would like to thank Chris for sharing experience with us tonight. Please help me close with the Lord's Prayer.
How are you? How are you?
Hey, excuse me a second. I want to present a medallion to somebody. Sherry?
Sherry.
Our Sherry has 17 years.